Welcome to the podcast. You've got two of us here tonight, actually. You've got, of course, myself with Stan the Fury Dragon. And we are joined tonight by none other than Mr. Joe Garrity of the Origin Museum. Hello, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
All right. So, why are we here? What are we talking about tonight? Well, it just so happens that there was some really... I suppose in a roundabout way, we're going to wind up talking about is kind of some of the, pardon me, I'm still not entirely over this cold. Some of the limitations, I guess, of crowdfunding, or not so much the limitations of crowdfunding itself, but you know, where the limits are in terms of what those of us who back crowdfunded projects can, you know, then expect or even, demand from that project.
Personally, for me, I don't see a lot of huge issues regarding it. I mean, there are so many different areas to take this and so many different topics with to touch on with this stuff. I mean, in my opinion, first of all, Kickstarter doesn't have investors. They have donors. And I mean, the big topic for me that you're touching on, if you don't mind me giving the input, my personal take on this, is that the people who gave money toward the Kickstarter are not quote unquote investors in the company. So they don't really have a right to need to see financials and responsibilities and things. It would be great on the part of the staff, but I don't think they really owe anybody anything. You donated to this. We're obligated to produce a game for you. There hasn't been any major disruption in service. So, you know, my personal opinion is, do they owe this to the donators?
Yeah, and I mean, that, like, you hit the nail on the head there, because... You know, what is the nature of a Kickstarter pledge, right? And you're right. Like, I think of it much more in terms of, you know, like, it's a donation, you know, like, I'm chipping this money in, and, you know, that's basically the end of it. It's like, I have chipped this money in. Ideally, I would like to see a finished product, and I'll feel butthurt if I don't, if for whatever reason the project craters. But realistically, you know, it is not unlike any other charitable donation. I mean, you know, you mentioned Star Citizen, and obviously, you know, you've got this Derek Smart doing all of his muckraking. Mm-hmm. And again, like, you know, and I mean, he was, you know, like, it was kind of a lowball investment on his part. I think he was only in for $250, if I recall correctly. And that seems to be that he's poured out a lot of fire and brimstone for, you know, $250, which he doesn't seem to be hurting for. You know, he seems to be doing all right for himself otherwise anyways. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't get that. Because, I mean, the other one that I can think of is Shroud of the Avatar actually does have its analog. I think Portalarium have managed him a little more deftly, because he really has just kind of been relegated off to the fringe. But there's a guy called, what does he call himself? Insane Membrane, who just like viciously trolls.
Oh my.
The Avatar.
Yeah, I've seen that. Well, I haven't seen his stuff as much as I've seen the reaction of other donators to Shroud. And he... He is successful. Troll is successful.
Yeah, he's.
I know a lot of people that get so frustrated by this guy.
Yeah, he's an interesting one for sure. I do actually follow his website and forum fairly closely, just to more for like a threat intelligence kind of thing than anything, right? Because I mean. Like, we know he still has some fairly high level access to the Shroud of the Avatar forums. I believe he still has one account that's, you know, got Dev Plus access. So, you know, it's interesting to, keep track of, you know, what he's looking at. But anyways, but he's been a lot more handily managed. Like, he's really off to the side, and he does elicit reactions, but it's not like, you know, he's not getting written up in, at, you know, MMORPG.com or Tent on Hammer or any of the other sites that have graced Shroud with significant coverage. Not like Smart and, you know, like, I mean, I know Ink Gamers covered him, I think, a little bit. PC Invasion has covered him a fair bit. The Escapist, of course, has really devoted a lot of attention to him as well.
Well, Insane Membrane is no Derek Smart, that's for sure.
Well, also,
I mean, Derek Smart has a long and glorious, albeit questionable, history in the game development industry. Insane Membrane is some really upset fan.
Yes, possibly Australian. That's about the only thing that I possibly know about him. But anyways,
I think Derek Smart gets the press because he's the, you know, because he is a game developer himself.
Yes, and he's had some. But you know, the interesting thing about Smart is he'll happily admit the spectacularity of his failures, right? You know, because he's had a few high profile crash and burns, as it were, but. Which he'll admit.
I just always seem to imagine, you know, Derek Smart's home being filled with like broken lamps and TVs with boots sticking out of the glass, and you know, he's a very angry man. You know?
Yeah,
his poor dog has bandages all over it and things.
You know, he writes very differently than he talks, too. Like, I've actually heard him on the PC Invasion podcast. Oh. And he talks. He's arrogant. There's certainly a lot of arrogance to him, but he's definitely not. He doesn't really come across as being, you know, as angry when speaking as he does in what he writes, necessarily. So.
Well, I know he made me a little bit nervous. He seemed to pop up in my Facebook friend of a friend kind of thing, so I got to see the post before anything hit the fan. And I wrote my reply because I'm a backer to Star Citizen, and basically very, very politely went, "What do you care? Why don't you just wait till the game comes out and then we'll see, because the proof's in the pudding." He replied with a 2.5 page tirade on my sentence and a half of, you know, calm down, and what will come, and we'll see what happens. And he was very upset, and I kind of slowly backed away, and, you know.
Yeah.
Made sure I stopped smelling like meat.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I haven't engaged at all, personally, so. But, you know, if there's a difference, I suppose, with. There's going to be a lengthy pause because I hear the baby crying. So you're going to have to give me a few minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we interrupt this broadcast with a special message from the Origin Museum. I'm trying to fill for time, but while Kenneth is dealing with duties, he said duties, I can basically just talk about my impressions on this. I personally believe that whether it is Star Citizen or Shroud of the Avatar, we donate this money to our favorite Kickstarters because we believe in the developer's integrity to work on producing a game. Anybody who invests in a Kickstarter is probably passionate about gaming in general. And if they're passionate about gaming in general, they do understand that in the gaming industry, stuff happens. And the idea of games slipping or not being released with all of the promised original thoughts and ideas and concepts is just the nature of the biz. As we all well know, Kickstarters are basically an alternative to going to a giant publisher on your knees and holding out your hands and saying, please, sir, will you help fund our small little project? And, you know, the giant gods, much like the Beatles and starting Apple, they wanted to do something beautiful and basically go, let's do it directly for the fans, which is wonderful. I think the interaction with the fan base while the game is developing personally is well worth the ticket price to see this stuff. Those of you who have gone through Kickstarters with Shroud of the Avatar or Star Citizen can see that both of those projects, they cater directly to what the fans want and give them updates sometimes on a daily basis to say, here's what we did today in helping make your game. And these famous developers make themselves accessible to the fans. You know, I'm sorry, but they do so much regarding that to basically give fan satisfaction that I have been personally completely satisfied with everything that these companies do. It's well worth my investment to be able to get an inside look at the development of the game. And if anything, this drama that goes on, I personally believe is kind of part of the show. It takes the curtain away from, pulls back the curtain for gaming development and lets people see exactly how this stuff goes. Hopefully for the best, but sometimes for better or worse. And I personally think that it is a phenomenal way to see not only how hard game development is, but to constantly give people information on the development of their game that they want, the game they so passionately decided to donate some of their hard-earned cash for. Are the donators considered investors? A lot of people would say yes. I personally don't believe so. But some people basically believe that, yeah, if I gave money to it, you are obligated to me to cover, you know, to make sure that you are investing my money properly.
There we go.
But it makes for a good story. I just filled, you can cut out whatever you like.
Yeah,
I was just rolling with my personal opinions on that kind of stuff.
I look forward to listening to the 4.5 minutes or so that I have been absent. I just want to return again to that point that I was kind of getting into and then wandered off of, which, you know, like the nature of the Kickstarter pledge. And I mean, you talked about this a lot because in the end it is a donation, right? Like it's a lot more like almost like giving to a charitable organization rather than a, you know, it's not like you're investing. You're assuming a lot of the same risks as someone who's investing in a game in that, you know, I mean, the project could fail and that money could all be for loss.
And I totally agree with you on that. I think that you are a donator and not an investor. But a lot of people would disagree and feel as though the developers owe it to their fans to do with the Kickstarter money that the fans would want. I say as long as you end up producing a game, that's fine. But the whole idea is that you don't have to go on your knees to the big giant gaming gods and say, would you please fund my project? They say, why don't we just go right to the fans? And that's great. But it pulls back the curtain and lets you see behind the scenes, for better or worse, of game development. And I think it's well worth the price of admission. I mean, this Crown of the Gods drama that goes on, that would have been worth my $40 or whatever I would have put toward that game just to see this kind of stuff. You know, I mean, you're probably getting more passion from the fans because of Kickstarter, because they feel they have a more active role in the development of the game.
Yeah. And it's just, I guess, really the only question is where the limit of that is, right? Because, I mean, on the one hand, you know, you are involving them more. And, you know, some companies, Portalarium with Shroud does this, In Exile did it with Wasteland 2. You know, you can involve them to a great degree, to the point that, you know, you are actually relying on fans to build systems for you, provide music, 3D models, things like that, you know, crowdsourcing, in addition to just crowdfunding. But on the other hand, you know, you could also be operating a closed shop, which is more like what Star Citizen is, right? They have their fans, they have their backers, they have a community, but at the end, it's Cloud Imperium that's doing all the development work, right?
Right.
It's their own in-house people. They're not, you know, saying, oh yeah, sure, you over there, you design us a ship, and you over there, you design us a tactical console script and things like that. No, it's just they're building it all in-house. So, you know, different approaches. And I mean, it's really, you know, to the comfort of the studio. But the larger point, you know, you can have those things. You can have the crowdsourcing, and you can have community engagement. But at the end of the day, you know, I think what we lose sight of, or what a lot of people lose sight of, is that, you know, when you're pitching money into a Kickstarter, hopefully, you're not pitching money into the Kickstarter saying, well, this is not a bad idea, but I want, you know, it to change in the following 10 ways. It's just, it's, you know, it's very much a case of, I like your idea. I want to see it come to fruition. Here's some money.
Correct. But as soon as you start getting into backer goals, does that imply that you are asking the fans, is this what you want? Well, because in relation to Star Citizen, forgive me for continuing to walk down that path, but
no, it's an example.
Being the Origin fan that I am, it's like Star Citizen, Shroud of the Avatar, and Ultima Underworld Ascendant.
Well, look, I'm only saying that, you know, on the video here, like, I can see the flight suit and the Wing Commander 4 banner in the background behind you. So, you know, I don't know why you're talking about this stuff, Joe.
You know, that's my wheelbase. But while I love Star Citizen and I can't wait to see the final product, and what I see tickles me and makes me giggle like a 12-year-old girl, I do understand the weaknesses involved in that. And my opinion is that with the goals and then with the fan interaction, sometimes there's a point where fans can interact too much and they try so hard to please people that they just say yes to everything. And that whole, I mean, this wasn't feature creep in regard to Star Citizen. This was, we're going to give the fans everything they could possibly want. So any question people had, they went, yeah, we do that. You know, no, did I back a first-person shooter in space? No. But apparently that's a big portion of it now.
Yeah. You know?
And I like to think I'm just going to pick and choose what I tried to back. I hope the single-player space game that I dreamed of when I handed them my money is what I'll get to see. Everything else is just cake for me. That's all I want to see. I want to see the single player aspect because that's the world I came from. And it scared me in Shroud that they were going to get off track and basically try to make a new UO when they never said that's what it was originally intended to be.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's a lot of actually, there's still a lot of concern surrounding that. I mean, certainly the ongoing like player housing stuff has been their biggest moneymaker in much the same way that ships have been a moneymaker for Star Citizen. And that's actually, right. You know, I got to admit that's to my surprise, because if you told me 2 years ago that Shroud was going to be able to make a fair chunk of money selling houses the same way that Star Citizen was selling ships and capital ships and things like that. I didn't actually think that was going to be possible, but you know, here we are, $7 million for Shroud now. way to go. Now, to be fair,
well,
I mean,
well, how else were they going to make their money?
Well, I mean, and that's the thing, right?
How many people are really going to pay an extra $6 for a natural dye tub?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they still do it for UO. What? Right. But it's, I mean, I can see one thing I think that Star Citizen is doing well, and I know Shroud doesn't have the budget for this, and I really wish they did, is that, you know, I think, you know, we can argue, but okay, yeah, I didn't back an FPS either. I want to fly around in a spaceship and shoot. I can't believe they're not Kilrathi. But, you know, I think one thing that that is being done very well with Star Citizen is the fact that, you know, like Chris wants to build his big MMO-ish thing, right? He wants to build this architecture of Star Citizen that is this online persistent universe. And Squadron 42, the single player component, is part of that. But rather than trying to also do that in-house, he basically dialed up his brother, who has, let's face it, been making excellent games for years now at TT Fusion. If you've played any of the Lego games, like, they are solid. They are rock solid.
Oh my gosh.
Excellent. Yes. So he basically called up
his, you mentioned that.
Yeah. So he basically called up his brother and said, hey, you want to do this part of it? I think that was very smart. I think, you know, if I have any reason for confidence that we will see an excellent Squadron 42, it's because they made that step. You know, they said, we have these different goals, these different objectives. This one, we are going to separate and we're going to hand off to these people who we know can deliver while we work on the rest of this stuff.
Right.
And I wish that, you know, Shroud could have that same separation where they could have like one team that was working on the multiplayer features and the housing and all the rest, and the other, and another team that was like isolated from that was just developing the core single player experience. Right. But that's the difference between $92 million. I think they're up to now, and $7 million. So, well,
and you touched upon the exact aspect. When you are donating that money for a Kickstarter, what you're really doing is backing the developers, not really the development. You're giving money trusting that the people behind the game will do the game the way that you hope that they do it.
Exactly. It's like I said, you know, they say, here's my idea. I say, hey, I like that idea. I want to support you in making this idea a reality. Here's my money.
But what, right. And where the tightrope begins is when you start suspecting that they're not doing, that they're not sure themselves how it's going to end up. That's where I start getting nervous. And because I'm such a fan, I'm not going to get into any specifics regarding that, but there are times where I question, do they know where their next step is going to be? Because in game development, it's always a tightrope walk. And a lot of times, you end up on a different rope than you started out on because, you know, things change, ideas change. People come up with better ideas. People come up with different ideas.
Yeah, or you try something and it just flat out doesn't work, right?
Correct. And a lot of times you just got to back up and then continue on the off-ramp, you know? We have to take a different path. This is part of what makes this whole Kickstarter thing so magical. Is that, like I said, you know, I keep making Beatles references, but, you know, it's like, let it be. Let's look at it warts and all. Let's see exactly. Let's go back to the beginning. We'll get back to our roots and show people exactly how it works, for better or worse. So in my opinion, it ends up being a terrific experience that I get to feel as though I had a hand in making this development happen. Even if it doesn't come to fruition, it was a wonderful ride. I've gotten more than my money's worth out of all my Kickstarters, except for Ascendant. They played very close to the vest. Have you noticed that?
You know what? I didn't chip in for that, so I'm not sure where they're at.
They don't talk a lot about it. It's the opposite tack. They don't have a lot of fan interaction. They just do their little reveals every now and then. Hmm. And I like what I'm seeing, and that's nice. But you go on the forums, and it's very, very quiet about opinions and whether they will interact with people. They just do little.
Oh, sorry. Underworld Ascendant. For whatever reason, I got to thinking about that Descent thing. Yeah, you're right about Ascendant.
Ascendant. Yeah. They play very close to the vest, and it's really neat to see three different styles and how everybody's working. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think with the case of Underworld Ascendant, like it's just that they're still very early on, right? Like they're still prototyping. So I don't necessarily know if they have that much to show yet, right? Like, I mean, we see their September prototype where we see a portion of the Abyss, and we can see that they've definitely got some systems being developed, and they're really starting to work on, you know, look, and like the Shadow Beast creature model looked actually really good, I thought. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, a lot of their previous updates, they've been talking about stuff. They've been talking about stuff, right?
Right.
You know, we're getting a look at, you're right, we're getting it in small pieces, you know, every couple of weeks, we're getting a little taste here and there, but what we're getting a look at is the very early part of development, right? The guys sitting around a table hashing out a system.
And then they hash it out, and what they give us is, this is what we're coming up with. You guys like this, right?
Yeah.
And regardless of what the answer is, they say, well, we're going to continue to plug along with this, and that's great, which is one way of developing.
Yeah.
Whereas Shroud basically goes, you know, we need your help. You know, let's get some music in here. And fortunately for them, that has worked out great.
Yes.
That little fan, what did you call it? It wasn't the fan contribution portion.
The crowdsourcing?
Crowdsourcing. The music. I forget, I'm embarrassed that I forget the name of the guys who produce.
Well, there's a few different contributors, so.
It's phenomenal. I am blown away by the talent. And that's an awful risk to take with a game, especially the music.
Well, because you can have such a fluctuation in quality, right?
Correct. And you could leave it to the fans and they don't come up with anything. And now you say, well, what the heck are we going to do about this? Well, quick, get a sound guy in, because we need some music by within 90 days. It must be terrifying to be able to let go of the bar like that as a developer. But luckily, the fans have come through like nobody's business. I am constantly impressed by the great work that the fans are doing music-wise in Shroud.
Yeah, well, I think there was probably never going to be that much concern on the music side, because I mean, you know, even if you look at like Ultima and the soundtracks for the Ultima games, I mean, how many remixes of Stones are there, you know?
Yeah.
So at least, you know, I think Shroud's advantage was that, you know, they were pitching this idea to a fandom that had already demonstrated its willingness to, you know, stand up and make its own interpretations of, you know, the music that had come before. So now they're coming in and saying, okay, well, you know, now you get a chance to do it for real, you know?
Yeah, but no disrespect to the Ultimate community, But I never saw a very, very large amount of, forgive me for saying so, but true raw talent out there. Mm. You know? You see people coming up with their own interpretation of Stones, and that's great. There's a million different versions. But as we all know, there are a lot of versions that are YouTube one-night throw-offs that probably wouldn't make the top 40, you know, on the radio.
True. But then on the other hand, you have like Grotto Dragon's work, which is just astounding.
Right.
Mind you, Grotto Dragon is a professional composer, so.
And that's why he stands out. Mm-hmm. And everybody says, wow. And he might be even a little insulted because he's like, well, I am a professional composer. You know, you kind of forgot that part.
But, you know, it's so, yeah, you're right. And I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of the people who stepped up to produce music for Shroud, you know, were, they'd either had some, you know, they were either had some training as musicians or had been trying to work their way into the music industry already. So, you know, you definitely had, and you did have a few people that, you know, sort of, kind of took it upon themselves to be, in essence, audio directors, right? So uh-huh. They would take, you know, submissions from other people. And then if they needed to like rework them with different instrument voices or whatever else, I think a lot of that happened too, right? So you did kind of have this informal process that sprung up whereby, you know, essentially an audio department sprung up independently. And you're right, like that's really cool that was able to happen. But then again, too, I think there maybe a lot of the benefit came from the UO side, right? Because Ultima Online always seemed to, you know, inspire community in that way, right? Like, you know, the guilds and the clans of UO, obviously, we're never able to contribute to Ultima Online's development, but that sort of, you know, highly detailed organization was very, very common.
I see where you're going. Yeah, I understand.
So, I think maybe that's where a lot of that came from, if I had to guess. But then, you know, some of those guys, too, were just, you know, I mean, they had some exposure to Ultima or UO, but they were mostly just there because, hey, Shroud itself looks interesting. You know?
Yes, but one of the weaknesses of the human condition is, while I have passion for the game that I donated money to, while I have a good idea of taste and style, I have no talent.
Yes.
And that is typical of the large majority of, you know, the fan base, is that we all know what we love, but if we were actually forced to sit down in a room and go, all right, now do one yourself, very few people would be able to. I know I couldn't.
Yeah. No, definitely. That's true too. So it is good that, you know, there were people who had the passion and the talent that were able to step up and really fill in that gap. And much the same way with, you know, the 3D asset development or this Iniko who whipped up the instrument playing that featured in the most recent release.
Right. I mean, and you play off the talents of the fan base. And I guess it's easier when you are the developer and you can pick and choose. And you say, well, thank you very much for contributing. And then silently you go, boy, that was a real stinkeroo. We're not going to use that.
Yeah. You know, oh, yeah. If it comes to
but that. But you just don't say that and you pick the good ones that it works out that way. But I am constantly surprised at how talented the fan base actually is. I mean, we all talk like we, you know, oh, if this were my game, you know, here's how I would do it and blah, blah, blah. But like I said, if you actually put the rubber to the road, most of us couldn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, like, and that's not to say that there aren't, you know, legitimate forms of criticism. Like, I mean, I play Shroud, you know, as many releases as I can. I've missed a few here and there just for various reasons. But you know, like, I'll admit I have a hard time playing the game, you know, just because I find the UI difficult to grasp. I find the card combat difficult to grasp. I find the movement to be a little bit weird. So, you know, mind you, other people either don't seem to have or have gotten past those reservations. I don't know. So, you know, I mean, you know, the person who sits down and plays the game obviously has to be able to play the game. And if they're not able to, if they're not able to penetrate the, you know, all the various aspects of the game that, you know, are necessary to control it, then, you know, okay, there's there's a problem there. And maybe it only exists between the keyboard and the chair.
Right. And that brings us right back to that original mm-hmm. concept of do mm-hmm. donators have a right to consider themselves investors? I donated X amount of dollars to this game. You're going to make the game the way I want it.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I chipped in what I chipped in for Shroud of the Avatar, but I certainly didn't chip in at one of those levels where I got the free Akalabeth copy.
Right. So, however, I have seen that there are people who have donated $20,000, $30,000 towards Star Citizen.
Oh, yeah.
But does that mean that they get an active role in deciding exactly how the control mechanisms are going to work? I don't think that would be fair.
No, I mean, and I think, too, like at some point it becomes at the developer's discretion, right? Like, you know, sure, if Portalarium wants to work with Winfield to develop a custom template for the Pax Lair player-owned town, that's their thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Winfield...
And that's their prerogative, right?
You know, Winfield has certainly chipped in enough money, you know, if they're willing to entertain him for, or entertain his design input and put a couple of weeks worth of developers' time toward that. Well, he certainly chipped in enough money to pay those people for their time. So, you know, great. All power to him. But that's at Portalarium's discretion, right? And if Chris Roberts doesn't want to go that route, no harm, no foul.
I agree with that. A lot of people would disagree.
Yeah. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, and again, it comes back to what I said, you're backing that developer's vision. If that developer wants to invite you to contribute to the vision, you know, then that's a unique privilege and you're really lucky to have it. But it is at the developer's discretion. And if the developer says, we are going to continue to make this according to our vision without, you know, inviting people to contribute and modify it in some way, that's okay too, right? Like, you know, you're backing that vision. Now, you can argue that, you know, okay, well, but now the vision has changed and I don't like how it has changed. I mean, I can see where the discomfort comes in. You know, you mentioned like, you know, like you and I didn't back the first person module of Star Citizen. I didn't back Shroud because I have any interest in playing multiplayer. But so long as the things that I did back are being worked on, where's the problem, right? Now,
and even if I don't like them, you brought up the card combat of Shroud. Mm-hmm. I don't like the card combat of Shroud, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to get angry about it. I mean, it's just a different control mechanism, and that's okay. It's something new. It's something different. And isn't that what we backed these things for? Something new and something different?
Or even just, yeah. And I mean, and that's the other thing too, is like, you know what? At the end of the day, Shroud will be completed and released in some form. It'll have its single player campaign. It'll have a particular UI that is used to then interact with it in order to complete that single player campaign. It'll have the systems that it has. I will either find these systems to be entirely too tedious to complete the game, or I won't, at which point I'll be able to complete the game.
Right.
But you know what? Either way, you're right. I did back it more because I want something about what it's pitching. I want to see that in the gaming industry. Even if I don't sit down and finish the game myself, I wanted to support, you know, an idea that I think we need to see come back. I wanted to support particular individuals whose work I respect. And, you know, that's the end of it. Much the same with Star Citizen. I backed it, and Everspace as well. I just backed Everspace on Kickstarter not too long ago. Because you know what? We need space shooters. They need to come back. Right? And that's, you know,
I agree.
That's if Star Citizen is the vehicle to, you know, bring back excellent space combat simulators, and that
listen to me, Mr. Origin Museum.
Yeah.
Mr. Origin Museum. No, I don't think space shooters
will come back. No, they've had their day.
No, not at all.
I don't ever shut up about Galaxy on Fire 2. I clearly don't care about space shooters either. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, Star Citizen comes out. It's, you know, yep, Squadron 42. You play it. You enjoy it. It's awesome. Or, you know, maybe it's only mediocre. But you know what? Maybe that means that instead of just a new Battlefront game, we get a new X-Wing game. Right.
Right. And maybe a couple of the original donators, the backers for it, think to themselves, well, this isn't anything like I wanted it to be. I can do better. So start your own Kickstarter and show us, and I'll back it. You know, yep. If you give me the good reasons for it, it opens the world up to everybody. But what I think is most amazing about the whole Kickstarter backer concept and all this stuff is not so much what is happening now. It's the correlations that we make as researchers of what we've already seen happen. I don't want to sound too arrogant, but you and I personally have had experience dealing with these exact concepts, although we've never really meshed them together. The design documents for Ultima 9 that were, you know, recovered by basically you and I.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody, if you recall, everybody, Ultima 9 would have been a successful game if the Bob White plot had been used. And, you know, they were all stupid for not using the original Bob White plot. And thanks to the efforts of you and me, we actually really got our hands on the blasted thing and found out
that it was,
lo and behold, the separation of the Avatar and the Guardian as one being and the whole split thing, that was in the original script.
Yep.
And everybody was complaining about it, and we solved a 12, 15 year old mystery.
About 12 years at the time, yeah.
Yeah. Over that whole thing, and it's like, and it made, I personally believe that made a bit of a splash. And that's kind of my point, is that we're getting to see it happen now. The same thing that you and I uncovered, lo, those many years ago, but we're seeing it live now.
Yep. I mean, you know, for
and
me,
I say, that's worth my money. I already got my money's worth out of this thing, just following the drama and the soap opera of all these different games and how development actually works. When the concept of Kickstarter first was imbued upon my brain, is it what I imagined? No. I thought I would be taking a more active role, but I, for one, feel as though I definitely got my money's worth out of just following this stuff.
Well, and that's the thing, right? And I mean, like, you and me both got, you know, a second dose of that too, right? Like, when we were invited to kind of get a little bit of a behind the scenes look at Ultima Forever.
Oh yeah.
And then, of course, you know, like, I had some additional follow up on top of that. So, you know, getting to step in on the, and see the progress of the game at a couple of other points. And yeah, I mean, and I think that's really the thing, is that, you know, I think because, you know, me and especially you have a lot of these deeper insights into just what a mess game development is, you know, and just how turbulent it is. We can kind of look at these things and say, you know, well, it turns out that this isn't something unique to publisher-owned studios. It turns out that this is just how game development works. And here's this indie project and that indie project and this indie project that are all going through those same turbulences. And we can sit back and we can, you know, draw those parallels and say, yeah, okay, this is, I guess these are just the growing pains that all projects experience.
Right. And what cracks me up is that we, in the end, are nothing but consumers, right?
Yeah.
But over the years, we've ended up getting, I mean, they talk about in advertising, what is it, buyer trust, you know? You see the name Procter & Gamble, and now you think that's a big, strong company, and you say Microsoft. It's a big, strong name, and it has a lot of years of experience, and you trust the brand for what you buy, be it Dell or, you know, Creative Labs, if you want to go back that far, and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's a big, strong name. I'm not going to buy anything but Sound Blaster from this time on and all that stuff. But we have this impression that these people know what they're doing.
Yes.
But as you and I both know, in our respective jobs that have nothing to do with the game industry, in reality, it's organized chaos. And people are running in circles sometimes, and projects move forward, and some projects don't. And some projects just go in a circle for a while until somebody goes, we've wasted way too much money on this. Just dump it, and let's move on to something else. Let's start going through this. And game companies are exactly the same way. You know, do you really think that Microsoft is exactly the way they are in the press releases and the research and development that they do? No, it's most probably the same as your job that you go to Monday through Friday. You know, that there's that guy that talks too much. There's the, you know, there's the lady that doesn't work as hard as everybody else. There's that guy that makes all the mistakes. There's the guy that deleted that directory. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do about him? Mm-hmm. You know?
And maybe it's even almost worse in like the game development context, because, you know, you have a lot of these people who have, you know, creative types, right?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. The creative mind is not as organized sometimes.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's bad enough, you know, at like my team at work, when you have five or six technically minded guys who have strong personalities butting heads. Now imagine that we're like a bunch of like really, you know, just out there creative types, where, you know, I don't know what it is. It just seems like that just is always attended by so much additional drama over and above, you know, the base level that you kind of expect anywhere.
And that's always one of the best stories as an archivist that I have, is that we make this assumption that Electronic Arts is this big, strong entity that does everything, you know, although we hate it, they are a big, strong company and they must do everything right. And then you go back and you start talking to these developers and you say, well, what about the backups? You know, didn't you have all that stuff? And they go, what do you mean backups? We were just a mom and pop shop. We had no tape backups. We don't have any backups of this stuff. You know, I've been looking for Ultima 8, The Lost Veil for goodness knows how many years. And anytime I bring up that concept, they go, backups, what are you talking about? It was a bunch of independent computers. When we had the master copy, we used to put it, I was told they used to put a post-it note on the monitor of the computer that had the master data. And anytime anybody made a change, they weren't allowed to incorporate any changes until the piece of post-it note was on their computer. Now they're the master. That's how they actually ran their business. And we're talking 1996, 1995. I mean, it's really not that long ago.
No, it isn't.
And so we always sneer and laugh at each other because you go, your hard drive died in your personal computer. Didn't you have a backup? But how many of us really do back up our stuff regularly to a separate outside entity? you know, and all that stuff.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, I mean, you didn't have network drives. You didn't have, you know, SATA and RAID controllers in basically every computer, or software RAID support in Windows, or crash plan, you know, cloud backups, or all the rest, right? Visual Source Safe. Right. None of this existed. Mm-hmm. Or if it did, it existed, it either cost, you know, a whole village of legs and arms, or it was unstable and unreliable.
Right. That's my point, is that, and then we had that era of 4 or 5 years after we got all that network stuff where, oh yeah, we were backing everything up. But has anybody ever tried to restore it? Well, no, not really.
Yeah.
And you don't realize that you've been backing up 4 years of data that could never be restored.
Yeah, or that wouldn't restore the way you needed it to.
I'm sure there are 10 years worth of EA backup tapes that probably don't work.
Maybe. I was never able to convince Jeff Skalski to let me into that archive.
I know. Oh, my gosh. The saddest part, though, is that I'm not holding my breath because I'm pretty sure we'd never find anything.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Or, I mean, well, and just think about how much there must be, right? Because, I mean, you know, it's all nice to think that we could find that needle in the haystack, but let's, you know, I mean, Origin is one studio, you know.
Correct.
How big is EA's backup archive? You know, how many studios, and just, you know, not just the studios, but, you know, all the corporate stuff, the financials and all of that stuff. Like, you know, there is so much that gets backed up above and beyond, you know, that one project's source code, you know, hopefully the tapes are labeled, but if my experience of that is any indication, the tapes aren't labeled.
Oh, no, they're not.
Or if they are, it's like, you know, some obscure like acronym and then like one of four.
Right. And that's the funny thing is that if you remember all of those acquisitions by EA, you know, Origin and Bullfrog and, you know, all of those little companies that basically EA bought up were all done in the early 1990s. From like 1990 to 1995 is when they were.
Yeah, that was, you know, the big acquisition.
Basically going, we're going to put them all under the EA umbrella. Well, you would think that if they go, hey, Origin, we're buying your company from you. Here's $45 million or whatever the heck it was. Wouldn't you think they went, now give us all of your archive backup tapes?
I imagine.
And knowing the history of Origin like I do, do you really think that Origin went, oh yeah, here's all of our organized backup tapes, you know, organized by directory of all of our current products. If I gave somebody millions and millions of dollars to buy their company, I want all of their resources.
I imagine the most that happened at Origin was probably a company-wide email saying, so does anybody actually have source code?
Oh, I am completely confident that a physical tape exchanged hands from Origin to EA executives. And that's all I'm going to say that I'm confident on.
Yeah.
What was now it? Getting into the weeds and knowing how Origin's organization actually was. Was there anything on those tapes? I'd love to find out.
But find the tape. Who knows what it is? Who knows what the label even says?
Yeah.
Why does this tape say
probably in a wet cardboard box somewhere in a basement?
Yeah, something like that. All right. Well, I'm going to have to wrap this because I still have like three other things to do tonight. Kid's birthday's coming up. Got to take care of a couple things. So a couple of quick things. Joe, is there anywhere we can find you online? I know that you have like this ancient Flickr account. That has a bunch of Origin Museum photos on there. Do you really have any other online presence? No?
No, I have no other online presence. Okay. I was so small that it wasn't worth actually making, you know, updating and keeping my website up and all that stuff. I mean, thanks to the wonderful patrons of the Ultima Codex, you're able to do that. I didn't have the financial wherewithal to be able to keep that up on my own for, you know, back in the day, the 10 or 20 people that would visit me on a regular basis.
Yeah, no worries.
So, no, I don't have a presence. However, I can be found very, very easily posting all kinds of fun little stuff on the Big Box PC Game Collectors group on Facebook.
Okay. I will make a note to add that group as a link for you.
A fantastic bunch of folks.
Big Box PC Gamers Facebook.
Game Collectors, yes.
Big Box PC Game Collectors? Mm-hmm. That's the full name.
Correct.
I should know because I'm a member too. But anyways, all right, cool. So there will be a link to both of those, to the old Origin Museum Flickr account and to the Big Box PC Game Collectors Facebook group, in the show notes. And of course, you can find me online. I mean, I'm on a Twitter at WTF_dragon. I'm on Facebook. Of course, the Ultima Codex, ultimacodex.com exists, or about.me/Kenneth.Cooley, K-U-L-L-Y. Easy places to find me online. Get in touch. And on that note, if you would like to recommend anyone for a shout out, you can drop an email to the Ultima Codex either through the contact form on the site or just shoot an email directly to ultimacodex@gmail.com. If you want to suggest podcast topics or comment or criticize podcast episodes, volunteer your time as a contributor. That is a great way to do any of those things or all of those things. If you haven't already, you should totally sign on with the Ultima Dragons group on Facebook. There's also an analogous community on Google Plus. And there's the underused UDIC hashtag on Twitter. Whatever your social network of choice, if it's one of those, the big three, there's some options for you. And if you like spam humbug, please do think about leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Podbean or wherever you happen to listen to us. Finally, there is, as Joe kind of alluded to there, there's the Ultima Codex Patreon. The $1 pledge gets you access to these episodes the day before they go live on the Codex proper. And you'll be helping maintain and, with sufficient funding, expand the server infrastructure of the Codex to better deliver everything you come looking for thereat. Whether it's, you know, all the lovely gallery articles, so many of which Joe here has enabled to be posted, or Shroud of the Avatar's IRC, or my own witty or occasionally half-baked commentary on news and current events within the Ultima fandom, whatever. Alrighty, well, I think that brings us to the end. So, Joe, would you care to sign off?
Well, thanks everybody for listening, and I appreciate your continued support of, you know, Ultima Codex, because it is probably the penultimate resource of Ultima stuff. And thanks everybody for listening.